session number 24825, Rule 6.
In relation to the situation, obviously, of your POW existence, you mentioned work. When were you started on work?
Well, we were sent into Munich, into camps which held the 500 men as a figure. We were housed very comfortable, if you can, yes, comfortable. We had all had our bunks. We had a couple of blankets each in the winter time. We also had a stove within the quarters to keep warm. And once we were settled down in this camp, firms around Munich area required certain numbers of men in order to assist in the production of whatever they were working on. So a working party would vary in size. For example, the water board, I suppose, they were mainly interested in trench digging to put their pipes in the ground, and there would be 30 men on that party. In my particular party, we were very fortunate. I think there was a dozen of us, and we worked for the town asphalt works. And it was quite a good period in my life, if a man can put it that way. The job of that firm was maintenance of the roads around the city. This required the production of bitumen to go on the roads, and also tearing up bitumen, taking it back to the depot, reheating it, making it available to go out on the roads again. A colleague and I got a job in the fitting shop there. I knew a bit about welding and he knew a bit about mechanics, and between us we did very well. We had three or four German workers in the same machine shop with us, and they were gentlemen, and we got that way. They were gorgeous mates, that's all. And they could. It's rather strange. The day we got there, we were marched into the place early in the morning. The foreman of the firm, big German bloke, he had to sort us out. He had no knowledge of English. We had no knowledge of German. Finally, we realised he's trying to find out who was the oldest. Well, we had one very old bloke. He must have been nearly 30. And he takes you to the door of this canteen where we were, and opens the door and sings out for Hans. Hans comes over. There's your mate. So he was on a delivery van around the town. He never saw the guards from morning till night. He separated us out. Some were on handling the material to make up the metal and the tar mixture to go on the roads. They drove electric little wagons around everywhere. And one chap had the job as the director's gardener. There was a patch of earth in the yard that he had to look after, and that was all right too. And the overall scheme of things, we all sort of settled in. In due course, we got fully equipped in British Army clothing, such as boots, socks, long underpants, singlet, shirts, pullover, even overcoats. So in that respect, we began to lift our morale again, because we were looking good, we were dressed better than most Germans, and Red Cross parcels come through regularly, so that you made it up with a bloke and you got one parcel per man per fortnight. So one bloke would get his parcel 1 week and your mate would get the parcel the next week, and this way you kept things going. In those parcels there would be a block of chocolate, there would be butter, cigarettes, which you could flog around the black market of Munich, and gradually elevate yourself all round. It was quite an experience.
I was interested to discuss that sort of system of bartering. within the prison system itself?
Well, yes, the main source of the main currency was cigarettes, and fortunately I didn't smoke. Now, you get 50 cigarettes a fortnight, you're a millionaire if you don't smoke. You could swap that for chocolate, you could swap it for anything in the Red Cross parcels. And gradually we started to do a bit of barter with the Germans. For example, we all had broken down, creased photographs of those whom we held dear at home. And I know a chap at the asphalt works there, he's an amateur photographer, and he did a roaring trade there with cigarettes and polishing and cleaning up photos and making them look good for us. We got that way you could buy a Lion Brow mug, pewter mug, or not a pewter mug, sorry, a earthenware mug, which was handy to make tea out of. And of course tea was always a system of barter amongst the Germans.
So they had a pretty awful coffee, didn't they?
Oh, they had, well, we maintained their coffee was made out of ground up Jarrah blocks. But it was terrible coffee, whereas they were very keen on tea. And one of our chaps there worked in the rubbish tip, and he just about equipped the camp with all odds and ends of living. Our particular little room had a stove, and we had a teapot that must have stood about 12 inches high. Beautiful thing. It has seraphims and angels all over it. And the shot was there, you'd steam the end off the end of your packet of tea and tip it into a little jar, and you put the packet in another jar so that it wouldn't get damaged. Then every time you made tea in this pot, you added to it. You never threw the tea leaves out. Then when the pot was full, you would dry the tea leaves out and put them back in the packet, and you would get a kilo of sugar for that. So. And if the Germans complained, you'd just say, "Ah, England kaput," and they'd say, "Yo, yo, yo," and that was a good business.
In relation to the situation as bartering went, were there people in command of that trade? How were they elevated?
I don't know. We did suspect that with the tea racket, the Germans were taking so much of this crook tea that it must have been going somewhere else. It wasn't the bloke we'd given it to. And this went on through all the work parties, not just our work party, so there must have been a bit of a lurk going on there. I don't think cigarettes went far. They might have. I mean, if you strike a good bargain with a German and give him, say, 5 cigarettes, well, he could probably do quite a bit with that himself if he wanted to. The same would go for a block of chocolate or something of this nature. We used to get soap. Good quality, so little things which were necessary, but which intrigued the Germans, because England was completely kaput as far as they were told, and yet this stuff kept flowing through all the time. And of course we got some stuff, some Red Cross parcels from Canada. Well, how do they get from Canada? You know, the U-boats wouldn't allow that sort of thing. And it was a big morale booster too, or a demoralizer for the Germans, a morale booster for us.
What of the people, the other prisoners, were there racketeers in relation to gangs forming?
No, I wouldn't say that, no. No gangs forming around the camp, no. No, there was still a strong sense of military correctness amongst the boys. And again, as I say, we had our administrators who were non-commissioned officers, particularly the chaps who were higher up, sergeant majors and so on. They maintained discipline amongst the boys. There was never any reporting things to the Germans, put it that way. They'd pull a man into line verbally, as a sergeant major would do. That would be as far as it would go.
And in relation to keeping yourselves disciplined, I understand, was something that helped keep
Well, again, yes, you would, of course. It was drilled into you that you were still a British. For example, our medical officers, they were in the camps. That was the British medical officers. Doctors and so on were out on these work parties as well, as to maintain the good health of the men. Padres too. They were also stationed in these camps. You might have a Padre who maybe do several camps around the town, you know, stay overnight in one of this nature. But that the guidance was there. You weren't neglected. And gradually stuff, medical equipment came through the Red Cross, and the doctors were able to maintain most things. If things went really bad with the man, the Germans put him in hospital. Because that was that. That happened several occasions. So, one another occasion which is of interest, getting back to Crete. I said there, I think at the end of the second day, we're in the vineyard right by the airstrip. A fellow there got badly bitten by a poisonous snake, and he was screaming there for all he was worth. It woke everyone up, of course, and the German guards come in and picked him up, put him in a truck, raced him into Retimo, straight to the German doctor, straight away. And the German doctor could speak English, and he says, another 15 minutes, he says, you would have been gone, mate. So, you know, they have that attitude that you've got to look after soldiers, they're soldiers. And that is a line of approach that they constantly brought up to us. Don't forget, you are still soldiers, which worked too on occasions.
I'm interested in this aspect because there is this sort of sense of fair play and the sort of game that one is involved with, almost to a certain degree. I mean, people talk of playing, you know, cricket, the Germans at least played a game that people could understand. Your war is over. Mm. You're literally you've lost. Mm. You marched off the field and almost sort of patted on the back in the change room. Was that something that you experienced?
Amongst the civilians, early in the piece, yes, the civilians I work with, more or less, put it that way. I know several times there, fellas, the Germans I was working with used to shake their heads and say, what are we fighting a war for? You and I get on all right. What's it all about? But again, I'm convinced that the German population did not know the functioning of the Nazi Party and what it was up to in the background. I'm quite convinced of that.
In relation, obviously, as your time draws on as a POW, people talk of the purpose of the POW in relation to the wider war.
Mm.
Disruptive behaviour. Was this something that you thought of?
Oh, yes. Yes, we pulled on a few like that. One I can clearly recollect, the manifold of a tractor at this firm had cracked. And I had said I was a welder. So they gave me the job of welding it up, and I managed to disintegrate quite a portion of it in the Smithies Forge. Well, this put that tractor out of action for 6 months. That was one thing. Other blokes would do little things that might become annoying. We had fellas get out of our camp at night and come back before daybreak. That was another episode. It was funny all the time, actually. The ceiling of the rooms we were in were of wood. They were in squares of wood, and we found you could prise them open. At the end of the day, at the end of the day, you'd be lined up in the passageway of this long building. The rooms would be on left and right, and you'd be counted. Well, we got that way. The German guard, we knew him, his name was Max, his offsider was John, they'd count you, you know, make sure you're all there. Well, as he moved down the line, the ones that he had counted would move into their room. But if someone was going out at night under the wire, they'd go up through the ceiling and go along the top in the ceiling and come down at the far end, and there'd be the right number of men counted. And at night, they had a prowler guard on the outside of the wire. Two men used to prowl around all night. Well, all you had to do was just listen to where they were, and we had worked out a way how to get under this wire, and I'd made a few prongs to hold it down once they'd got out. So fellas used to go off out into Munich and prowl around there for the night. That's one thing that went on.
Some people say that it was easier to get out of some of these places than it was to get back in.
This is right, yeah. Mm.
What
yeah.
was your experience with that?
Well, I had some bad experience. Well, as I have told you previously, my memoirs are in the hands of a publisher at the moment. I don't know what will come of it, but when we were leaving Munich, a chappie who used to go up to the camp at midday to get a soup for the troops, for us, he came back and said, "We're moving." Well, we didn't believe him, but he said, "Yeah, they're all packing up." Well, I had made the acquaintanceship of a young lady in the district, and I didn't know how I was going to tell her, but I shot through. And when the party got back to the camp, of course, they were one man short. Anyway, I knocked on the door of where this lass lived and spent a very pleasant few hours with her and her mother and her father yarning over things generally, but then I thought, well, I better get back to camp. And when I got back to the camp, guards were going up and down and around the barracks with torches on all the windows. The windows had wooden shutters across them with iron bars, and they were making sure they were all there and so on. I had to shake the front gate to get any attention. And eventually the sergeant major came across and said, "What do you want?" Because I had a civilian hat on and a jacket. So I told him I could speak the language a little by this time. We'd been there 18 months. And, well, I'm a prisoner of war, can I get bed and breakfast in there? So he opens the gate. He does a mock bow. He says, "Welcome home," and into the commandant's office, bang, and there I was. Cut a long story short, there was about 10 or a dozen men missing from the camp at the end of the day, and the commandant was in a hell of an emotional state, because he should call out the Gestapo, the police and everything like this. But our British sergeant major had told him, "Now, hang on, they'll all be back, they'll all be back." Well, I was the second last one back, so he's very pleased to see me. I'd just taken around him a quarters and handed in. That's all there was about it. And I said to our sergeant major, I said, "Well, what's all this about?" He said, "Well, there's about a dozen fellas missing." He said, "But," and I assured him it'd come back, and he had a bright idea. If they didn't, he would accuse me of helping you all to escape. He said, "And then I'd be in trouble." So, and they all come back. They knew where one of them was, down at a house of ill fame, so they sent a couple of guards down to bring him back, and there was nothing ever said about that episode. So that's one example, just how they fitted in together.
I'm interested to talk about it. Here you are, prisoners of war, and you've got liaisons with the opposite sex happening outside, the barbed wire, and people are hopping off to the places of ill repute and all the rest.
Yeah, well, every camp had a notice board, and prominent on this notice board was fraternising with German women is punishable by death. But when you're young, you don't pay any attention to that sort of thing. And it doesn't happen overnight, it's the acquaintanceship. It's something that you just cultivate over a long period of time. And
but the fact that you had this time to
get
to know one another.
Yeah, well, it's a peculiar thing, but this last used to go past a big window where I was working at a bench every day, and after about a fortnight, well, you start to look at this, and then you tap the window one day and you're ignored. You tap it the next day and get a look, and the third day you get a smile, and then you realise that midday she goes the other way. She's going home for an hour, and there's a door in the next room. You come out of this room into that room, and there's a door on the wall there that goes down that street. Well, all the workers are up in the canteen having lunch, so you soon make a key that fits that door, and gradually you get to know someone. That's as simple as that. Yeah. But her parents were delightful people too. They had no sense of animosity. Yeah. And I will say, we years after I wrote to her, and even after we were married, my wife used to get a parcel together every Christmas and send to her. Oh, yeah. So it was, you know, quite a nice relationship. And gradually, of course, over 50 years, it's dwindled away, and I don't know where she is now.
Yeah. In relation to the idea that you could almost come and go as you please to a certain degree, What were the thoughts then of things like escape?
Oh, escape was on all the time. The Germans regarded it as a springtime sport for most of the war, until things got very grim at the finish. But it was if you escaped and eventually caught, you're taken back to Moosburg. You might spend 10 days in solitary confinement, and that would be the limit of your punishment. So, and quite a few fellows, because Munich is not so very far from Switzerland, and quite a few fellows had a go at this sort of thing. I can recommend a book called The Escape Artist by Alf Passfield, who was in our working party at the town Asphalt Work. He would be about the biggest headache the Germans ever captured, I'm pretty sure. He got a military medal anyway for being a bloody nuisance. That's how he was, but it's a remarkable story, but it was typical of what went on. And fellas just escaped, had a go. If they got caught, well, they were brought back, punished in a military way, and sent out to work again.
Tell us about the committees that were set up in relation to escape.
Oh, in our little work parties, there would be individual efforts. There'd be no committee within the camps, no, because there's only 500 men, and we're out all day. Your guard would take you to, you would march to where you're going to work for the day, and you wouldn't see him until you were counted and taken back at night. You'd be under the care of the civilians. Well, it was easy as hell to slip away, and so that was no problem. You didn't have to have a committee.
In relation to situations about, you mentioned that you'd heard the Japanese were now in the war, and obviously that had happened in December, so a little way after your taking at Crete, but in relation to the situation with the Japanese coming into the war and some of the other things that you were hearing, what were you able to glean about what was going on in relation to the outside world?
While the Germans and the Japs were winning, of course, you were made very much aware of it, what they were doing. And it was a very low point, or not just for us POWs, for the whole of the British Empire at one stage there. And things looked very grim, of course. Germans were tearing across Russia, and the Japs were tearing down towards Australia, and I'm afraid we had a horrible feeling of frustration absolute frustration, because you couldn't be there and there was no one seems to be stopping them. And this was a big problem, because you got your wife, or rather your mother and your wives if you're married. And so, you know, you worry about those sort of things, naturally. And also knowing the Japs were pretty cruel characters at the best of times, we knew that much by the history of Manchuria, for one thing.
So, what was some of the news you were able to get from home, if any?
We got letters from through the International Red Cross. We were allowed to write one letter a month, I think it was, and they reached home quite all right. And we in turn got letters from our parents. They were censored letters on special paper and so on, but we received them. Also, we could get personal parcels from our relatives. I got gear from my auntie in England and my mum here and my sisters, and it would be, the parcel would be open, of course, and checked and all that, but you got it. Yeah, you got it. Which was, again, very morale-boosting. Yeah. But getting back to the period you just mentioned, though, things were at a very low level then. The whole of Australia eventually became worried. I know damn well now that it took a long while for the Australians to realise that things were very bad and the country was threatened. And, well, I know the races went on, the football went on. It took a long while for the country to knuckle down. But everyone was worried, so were we. And things were bad. But we didn't doubt for one moment that we're going to win. I suppose that's one thing you always hang on to. You're going to win. You can't accept the fact that you might lose, because, well, if we did lose, hell, I'd be there for the rest of my life, I suppose, and eventually dump down a hole and covered over, because that'd be your value.
Some people that I've spoken to in relation to POW life see that as quite a beneficial experience. Some people were able to take classes and learn things. you mentioned yourself that you were working and learning a new trade almost in some
respects. Yes, in some respects. I did a study. I studied the learnt the German language a bit. I could hold a conversation with a German then. I don't think I can now, but I could then. We could understand each other, put it that way. And quite a few in the big camps, like officers and where NCOs were kept, yes, some of them did a lot of study, and they graduated after the war at a university of this nature, which set up their career for the rest of their life. But I never benefited much by it because, well, quite frankly, I come from a working class, and that sort of thing never occurred to me. It's only after the war that I realised that, you know, you can better yourself if you want to, mate. But I come through a depression, and I joined the army at the end of a depression, and there was, you know, that's your level in life, which, of course, is a horrible situation to think about. I'm no different now, but in fact, I can quite proudly say I've only developed since I retired, because I have.
In what way do you think?
Oh, well, I've educated myself quite a bit. I'm the state president of the Ex-Prisoners of War Association. This brings me in contact with leading figures within the city, such as the mayor, the governor, and the leaders of different organisations. I'm responsible for organising certain events at which these men are invited, where you have to shape up the protocol. I'm also a mentor at one of the local high schools for kids that are a little bit off the beam. And in addition to that, of course, I belong to the Veteran Athletes Association, the Over 45 Kayak Club, the Over 55 Cycling Club, and I'd like to do a lot of writing. I've had a book of poems published, and as I say, my memoir is in the hands of a publisher, so I've developed.
Can you see that some of these qualities in you were developed early on in the POW days, for instance?
I wouldn't say they were developed, but they were there and they lay dormant, I think. Oh, now wait a moment. One year I wrote the Christmas pantomime for the working party of Cinderella. I wrote all that out and organised that, so it must have been something there. We had a entertainments committee, and I was the president, and we had a secretary as well. We were paid in token money, and we used to charge the fellas $5 to come and see the show. Well, they'd pay that up, well, then we could hand that money to the camp officials, and they in turn could convert it to German money, and we could hire costumes and so on from the local village to help put on a better looking show. So, yes, I was involved in stage work then. Yeah.
Well, I'm interested. Obviously, you had an interest in being involved.
Yeah. Yes, I would say that. Yeah. You get involved.
Some people make more out of their POW days than others.
Mm. This is right, yes. Probably these things were there, and you carry it with you, the experiences you've had, and when the time comes, for example, you take a computer. What a marvellous thing that is for writing on it. I mean, with a typewriter, you had to tear a page out and throw it away, or you had to use white paper. With a computer, you just go and you can change it around, and this way, that boosts your enthusiasm for writing. And again, I have to write quite a few official letters with the different organisations I'm in, so it all adds up. Yeah, I suppose you're right.
In relation to obviously taking charge and writing the pantomime, what was involved in that? What did you have to organise in relation to getting POWs to be involved?
Oh, you'd always get those willing to be in it. The pantomime I organised was Cinderella. So you get a group, the blokes say, well, look, we're going to put on pantomime, Cinderella. And one bloke's got a bit of a knowledge of carpentry, and he finished up making the stage scenery. We had some who had artistic talents, they did the scenery. We had a coach there that Cinderella arrived on, and it went off the stage, beautiful coach. again, you say what sort of people do you get? We had a bunch of Welsh coal miners, and they called themselves the Hairy Fairies, and they put on their own little magical fairy scene and ballet, and which was a bit tawdry, but still it was Welsh. And you could always get people like that. You'd get a fellow who was willing to be the leading lady, you'd get a fellow who was majestic in his attitude, and you'd get the servants. You could pick them out and ask them if they give you a hand. They'd always be willing to help. And we had a mouth organ band. You played the music, and that's how she went.